Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last month, the Department of Justice issued a scathing report that found evidence of systemic racial bias throughout the Ferguson Police Department and local court system. 21,000 people live in Ferguson, Missouri. While blacks make up 63% of the population, according to the report, they account for 85% of traffic stops, 90% of citations, and 93% of arrests. Blacks are twice as likely to be searched as whites, but less likely to have drugs or weapons. Attorney General Eric Holder said police compete to see who could issue the most citations to blacks, and the charges are often trumped up or fictitious. Fines from routine traffic stops, walking violations, failure to comply, and other petty offenses were used as money-making ventures by the city. And when people couldn't pay, they were arrested. In 2013, the city's municipal courts issued 32,975 arrest warrants for minor offenses. This is according to Missouri state records. The amount of revenue siphoned through citations rose 56% between 2001 and 2014. I'm sorry, 2011 and 2014, from $1 million to $2 million. When Ferguson Police Chief Thomas Jackson reported that his force beat our next biggest month in the last 4 years in revenue, City Manager John Shaw responded, "Wonderful." Well, they both resigned in March, and Ferguson Mayor James Knowles fired a police supervisor and suspended two others for sending racist emails. And then in a separate 86-page report, the DOJ cleared Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson of civil rights violations in last August's shooting death of Michael Brown. After evaluating the testimony of more than 40 witnesses, the DOJ said it found little credible evidence to contradict the account of Wilson. Meanwhile, city elections are set for next Tuesday. Eight candidates are vying for three city council seats with an unprecedented level of participation by black residents. On today's Your Call, we are continuing our series on police, community, race, and justice by talking about the responses to the DOJ report. What do residents think of the findings? How have police departments across the country responded? And what do you make of these findings and their larger implications? Today, we're joined by Ella Jones. She's lived in Ferguson for 36 years. Ella is president of the Ferguson Township Open Democratic Club. She sits on the city's Human Rights Commission, and she is running for Ferguson's City Council. Hi, Ella. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us. We are also joined by Chris Bridges. He's a civil rights advocate and attorney with Equal Justice Society. That's an organization that works to transform the nation's consciousness on race through law, social science, and the arts. And Chris joins me in studio. Hi, Chris. Thanks for coming in.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. So, Ella, you live in Ferguson, and I was just reading a couple articles. Activists are still wondering what is going to come from this damning report. What are you hearing from local people about what this report revealed?
The local people are really upset about what the report revealed, but more importantly, they are wondering why the city has not given us an opportunity to hear from them and what they're planning on doing about the report. But the people are very upset, and they just don't understand why the city is so quiet, and we are asking questions that we are not getting answers.
So at this point, there's been no, community gatherings to talk about this report, to have a dialogue between the local people and the police?
No. The only community gathering we had was on last Thursday, and the Justice Department came down, and they were invited in by One Ferguson, a community group here, and they had an opportunity to share with us some just basic information about the report and how we can encourage the city to work with us and see exactly how they are going to handle the recommendations.
And what was your personal response? A lot of people said that they weren't surprised, but the fact that this is an official report from the Department of Justice. I read a number of the findings, but one other one: when stopped by police, blacks in Ferguson were twice as likely as whites to be arrested, even though police found contraband for 34% of whites they stopped and searched versus 22% of blacks. And this is according to a criminologist on a team contracted by the Missouri Attorney General's office, Scott Decker. The report found that 88% of times in which Ferguson police used force, it was against blacks. All 14 cases of police dog bites involved blacks. And a lot of people are saying that this is a really big deal because it is an official report.
It is a big deal, and it's alarming and it's shocking that Ferguson would prey on the African American population.
And so, Ella, what's your overall response to this report? I mean, when you first heard these findings, you know, what went through your mind?
I got upset. I was mad. I was angry. I just couldn't believe why they would do such a thing. One of the things that I read in the report was very upsetting to me personally. It was an email that came out of the report, and I just quote what the email says, and it says, an African-American woman in New Orleans was admitted into the hospital for a pregnancy termination. 2 weeks later, she received a check for $5,000. She phoned the hospital to ask who it was from. The hospital said, Crime Stopper, end the quote. I think that's, I don't like that. That's disgusting. And for people to send out racist emails like that about people, it's unacceptable.
And that was Captain Rick Hank, or Hanky, who sent that email. He stepped down from his job with Sergeant William Mudd, a fellow long-serving officer who was awarded a medal more than 20 years ago. And this just came down, you know, weeks after the report came out. What about you, Chris? Just personally, what were your initial reactions to this report?
Unfortunately, I wasn't very surprised. I've been working in criminal justice and prison and police interactions for a couple of years now, and unfortunately, the same kind of behavior is very prevalent across the country. So I wasn't very surprised by the findings of the report at all.
I heard that from a lot of people, but how significant is this, just considering the fact that it is an official Department of Justice report and it got so much media attention?
Well, it's incredibly significant. A lot of people have been working in this area for a long time, and unfortunately, a lot of this evidence of similar practices across the nation has been largely swept under the rug or not given the proper amount of attention that it deserves and needs. And so the fact that the DOJ is coming out and issuing this report with all these really egregious findings very much so highlights the endemic problem that's there present in Ferguson, and also hopefully opens up a can of worms for all the other areas that might be experiencing similar problems, such as Ferguson.
As we were talking about, the report is rife with examples of excessive use of force. It's also rife with racist language. The Department of Justice has made several demands of the police department in Ferguson. They want a, quote, shift from policing to raise revenue to policing in partnership with the entire community. Also, police should act when it promotes public safety, not simply because they have legal authority to act. The DOJ says that if the Ferguson Police Department doesn't make changes, it will sue. What are your thoughts first on these changes?
I think the changes are welcome because anything that's going to be at least an attempt to try and correct some of the really problematic behavior is worth investigating or trying to explore further. In terms of whether or not it'll be very successful, I think that's hard to determine because there's a lot of problems that exist beyond just making surface-level changes to how the police operates or encouraging them to be more involved in the community. There are a lot of really significant problems that are entrenched within the entire police culture, with the entire community, in terms of how minorities, particularly African-Americans and Latinos, are viewed in communities and the ways in which police officers conduct their business. And this is, again, across the country. So while I encourage reforms or changes or hard looks at how to try and improve practices and procedures, there are still a significant number of issues that need to be looked at within the police departments themselves.
Also, a lot of people like Michelle Alexander, the author of The New Jim Crow, she says, obviously, this isn't just Ferguson. It's just that we had this major, major DOJ investigation. Do you think that we'll see more reports like this across the country?
I hope so. I certainly hope so. Unfortunately, a lot of the attention comes when something is so public, such as Mike Brown and his murder. So I don't want it to come at that cost, but I definitely think there's a lot of a lot of areas in this country where similar reports could be issued.
The ACLU has a number of studies on this. And for example, they found that Philadelphia police shot 400 people, over 80% African-American, in 7 years. And there's just, we've got a lot of data like this. Ella, going back to Ferguson, we have seen people resign. For example, I mentioned Ferguson Mayor James Knowles fired a police supervisor, suspended two others, and then Ferguson Police Chief Thomas Jackson and City Manager John Shaw both resigned in March. What are your thoughts about the fallout from this report?
Well, it needs to happen because Ferguson is run by the city manager, and the city manager hires the chief of police. And that type of behavior that came from the police officers should not be tolerated. And the mayor did one thing right when he separated the city manager and the chief of police from Ferguson and any other police that had anything else to do with this negative behavior and sending these bad emails out. And that's just the beginning, because the more you dig, the more I think you're going to find other people who were involved in this way they treated African Americans.
And also, Ella, in terms of just how this is affecting people's daily lives, I mean, let's talk for a little bit about the fines from the routine traffic stops, the walking violations, the failure to comply. When people couldn't pay for these violations, they were arrested. The city ordered over 32,000 arrest warrants for minor offenses in 2013. Revenue rose because of all of this, 56% between 2011 and 2014, from $1.4 million to $2.3 million. The Washington Post had a piece about this that looked at specifics. And Ferguson issued an illegally parked vehicle citation to a driver, a black woman. She got two citations and a ticket for $151. The driver, who has bounced in and out of homelessness, couldn't pay it in full. So over the next 7 years, she had to pay $550 because the fees just kept going up. So that's just one example of so many. But what are you hearing from people about how this is now affecting their interactions with police on a regular basis?
Well, a lot of people don't trust the police. They really don't trust the police. And the City of Ferguson Police Department has to do something to earn people trust. A lot of people, when they see the police, they, you know, tend to look another way or go to, it's so much fear, it's unbelievable. It's just too much fear going on. And they were stopping people, like kids were walking across the street. Well, some of the neighborhoods in Ferguson don't have sidewalks. Mm-hmm. So where do you expect the youth to walk? They're going to walk in the street. So to give people tickets for that is uncalled for.
Right, because they gave a lot of walking violations. In some cases, the investigation found the court charged $302 for a single walking violation, $427 for a peace disturbance violation, $777 for resisting arrest. Chris, how common is this across the country?
I think it's very common, and just to localize it to areas where I've worked at. So, for example, just last year, in 2014, in conjunction with the ACLU in Northern California Public Council and the Black Organizing Project, we did a similar study on the amount of interactions and contact with youth, for example, throughout all of Oakland. And so similar statistics were actually coming up when we broke down the data that they provided to us. So, for example, in the past 7 years, black youth made up 73.5% of all juvenile arrests by Oakland Police Department each year, even though they made up only 29.3% of the Oakland youth population. In the past 5 years, black youth were referred to probation department at more than 2.5 times their percentage in the population. We also found a significant amount of information suggesting that the vast majority of individuals who even had contact with the Oakland Police Department was over 70% of African Americans versus any other ethnic group in the city of Oakland. So, again, a lot of this stuff is happening, and it's almost kind of a training experience. So even to echo the sentiment of not feeling comfortable. Even as a young African-American lawyer, I do not trust police officers. I don't feel comfortable around police officers. And in Chicago, so this isn't Oakland, in Chicago, mm-hmm. I had an experience of being stopped by a police officer and unjustly having my entire car searched right down the street from President Obama's neighborhood, his house, actually. And the police officer said to me, while he put me in handcuffs and proceeded to violate my rights, he said, well, we don't know that you're educated when we pull you over, after asking if I was in college. So these experiences are happening all over the country. There is a lot of problems that are not being given the proper highlight or story. There are a lot of stories, a lot of narratives that are being shared in communities of victimized people, but aren't necessarily making it to the front page. And those narratives are often pushed down.
The fact that these cities are making so much money off of these violations is now getting a lot of attention. The Washington Post has done really good reporting on this.
Yes.
And again, this came out in the DOJ report that the police chief and the city manager are boasting about the money that is coming in. The police chief, Thomas Jackson, said, "We beat our next biggest month." City manager said, "Wonderful!" exclamation point in this report. Now, both of these guys resigned. Now, how common is that across the country? And is there any way of knowing having these kinds of reports?
Well, I think it's hard not to know, because it takes individuals actually investigating, well, what's the profit margin? What's actually happening with the citations that are happening? And that requires individuals actually specifically looking at the profits that are being derived from the tickets and then breaking it down by demographics such as race, gender, and age group. The piece of the over-contact of African-American populations and the over-contact of Latino populations by police officers flows into the question about why are so many individuals being contacted and then being penalized with financial costs and fees in order to make appearances in court or contest or fight or receive tickets. It's definitely prevalent. And I'm, again, not surprised that individuals are profiting or cities are profiting from the fees and the citations that are being allotted disproportionately against minority communities.
And specifically on this issue, what changes would you like to see? The DOJ wants a, quote, shift from policing to raise revenue to policing in partnership with the entire community. I'm not sure what that means exactly.
I'm not sure what that means either. I would love to see more details about how they hope to implement that. I think that, much to what many people have said and many folks feel, police officers are not necessarily trained effectively to interact with communities. So if the shift is to try and say that you should be officer friendly as opposed to looking for fees and citations against potential violators of whatever laws may be on the books, I think that requires a much deeper conversation about how you actually effectively carry out that call to action. So I would have to see more details from the DOJ in terms of how they hope to implement such a strategy.
Chris Bridges is a civil rights advocate and attorney with Equal Justice Society. That's an organization that works to transform the nation's consciousness on race through law, social science, and the arts. We're also joined by Ella Jones. She has lived in Ferguson for 36 years. Ella is president of the Ferguson Township Open Democratic Club. She sits on the city's Human Rights Commission, and she's running for Ferguson's city council. Next Tuesday, Ferguson holds city elections. 8 candidates are vying for 3 city council seats with an unprecedented level of participation by Black residents. And today on Your Call, we are continuing our series on police, community, race, and justice by talking about the scathing DOJ Ferguson report. It found evidence of systemic racial bias throughout the police department and the local court system. 21,000 people live in Ferguson. Blacks make up 63% of the population, but account for 85% of traffic stops, 90% of citations, 93% of arrests. The report found Blacks are twice as likely to be searched as whites, but less likely to have drugs or weapons. So what questions do you have about this report? It came out a month ago, and a lot of people are still asking, what changes are we going to see? What was your reaction to the report, and what are your thoughts on the changes that we are seeing across the country? We're seeing a lot of changes. Well, I shouldn't say a lot, but a lot of talk about changes in police departments and some specific changes, and we'll talk about those in just a couple of minutes. We'd love to hear from you. If you work on these issues, if you work with law enforcement, give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Mimi in Monterey. Hi, Mimi. Welcome to the show.
Two comments. The first comment is we've never really addressed the original problem, and part of that is that when you go into these communities, whether it is a predominantly Black community, predominantly Hispanic community, whatever, when you go into the places of authority, they're still predominantly white. So it ends up looking like a trail mix cookie. You know, it's predominantly white, and then you have a few Asian, a few Hispanic, a few Black people there, regardless of the actual population, whereas if it were, you know, in its natural order, you know, the people in authority would match, you know, the population that they have authority over. Then, two, when it comes to this data, a lot of times, you know, either it's not properly kept or when the public asks for it, you can't get it. And that's a huge problem here in Monterey County when you ask for information, you know, from those up on high, and it's not available. Or they can't find it, or whatever.
Right.
So if you could address those two points, I thank you.
Okay, thank you for calling in. So why don't we first talk about data? And we've done shows on both of these issues. There was a Death in Custody Act, which recently passed Congress, and that requires data collection on deaths. The ACLU says it's taking that approach by penalizing non-compliant agencies through Department of Justice funds. Earlier mandates around collections, ones that allow law enforcement to voluntarily report this data without penalty, are not working. So, Chris, what are your thoughts on data and how important is that?
Data is incredibly important. A significant portion of the work that I do is based off of being able to accumulate data and make analyses based off of all of the information that we receive, broken down again through race, gender, et cetera. So data is very important. It helps build a more thorough narrative in terms of what's actually happening on the ground in whatever locale is available. That is a very real concern in terms of the proper keeping of data. So a lot of individuals, whether it be school districts, police departments, everybody across the board, actually we've seen significant numbers of individuals who are not actually keeping accurate data. And it makes it very hard to really go in and make these analyses, make these conclusions, or make these proposals about how to properly change some of the policies or behaviors that are happening on the ground. So data is a really important thing. And forcing districts, forcing police departments, forcing city departments to be able to keep accurate data would significantly improve the ability to not only make a case, but also come up with proper solutions.
And what changes are you seeing around this issue?
Well, around data, I think it's slow-moving changes. So there's certainly a compliance factor in forcing individuals to comply with the needs of keeping accurate data. And so that's a slow-moving process. And thankfully, with groups like the ACLU working to push to make individuals more accountable for the data that they collect, as well as what type of data they collect.
And we have to take a break, but we will continue talking about data. And I'll also ask our guests about your other question in terms of the race gap in police departments. Today, we are talking about the Ferguson Report and its findings. What questions or comments do you have? What was your reaction when you heard about this report that while Blacks make up 63% of Ferguson, they account for 85% of traffic stops, 90% of citations, 93% of arrests? People who study these issues, like today's guest, Chris Bridges, says that this is not unique to Ferguson, that this is happening across the country. So what changes do you think, what changes would you like to see? If you're hearing about changes in police departments across the country, we would love to hear from you. And then what was your overall reaction to this report and then its larger implications? This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective that you haven't heard yet in today's discussion, or a question you feel needs to be answered, you can join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free call. If you'd rather email us your question or comment, the address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock, World Have Your Say from the BBC. At noon, This American Life. And then this afternoon at 1, Snap Judgment with your host, Glenn Washington.
is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll talk about how nonprofit health insurance companies like Blue Shield operate. We'll speak with Michael Johnson. He's a former Blue Shield policy director who says Blue Shield, a nonprofit, is no different than its for-profit competitors. He recently resigned over high premiums, multi-million-dollar salaries, and billions in profits. And then the state of California recently revoked Blue Shield's tax-exempt status. Do you think that Blue Shield should give back the profits it made while it received tax breaks? That's tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the scathing Department of Justice report that found evidence of systemic racial bias throughout the Ferguson Police Department and local court system. You can find more information about the report at yourcallradio.org. We'll also talk about this separate report that cleared Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson of civil rights violations in the shooting death of Michael Brown. What was your reaction to these reports? Are you seeing changes across the country? These issues are getting so much attention. In fact, NPR had a piece on Monday just about how Black men are dealing with their everyday lives. Chris, you just mentioned being stopped in Chicago. There was a guy on this NPR report saying that he whistles the Frozen song when he walks down the street to let people know that he's just going home to his family. So these issues are getting so much attention. Are you seeing changes? What changes would you like to see? What do you think is coming? What is the result of all of this information that's being exposed and discussed? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Chris Bridges is a civil rights advocate and attorney with Equal Justice Society. Ella Jones is running for Ferguson City Council. She has lived there for 36 years. And Ella, what about data collection? Do you know much about that, and has any of that changed in Ferguson?
No, I don't know much about that.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. Let's go on to the other question about the populations not matching, the police department populations not matching the regular population. The New York Times had a piece that found in hundreds of police departments across the country, the percentage of whites on the force is more than 30 percentage points higher than in the communities they serve. Chris, what would you like to say about the gaps that you're seeing here in the Bay Area?
Well, I think to back up a piece and just talk about the fact that I wonder what the data is also based off of the number of police officers that actually live in the communities that they're policing. So that's a big piece of it as well. Previously we were talking about the impact of a potential change, which would be having more communities style policing and having police officers really engage in the community as opposed to pushing them for citations and thinking of them only as money-making vehicles. Again, a huge concern being that if you have officers who don't even live in the communities that they're supposed to be protecting and serving, it creates this really large disconnect. And so a lot of individuals who actually are coming from those communities not only are being victimized by excessive representation in the criminal justice system, excessive ticketing, excessive fines, but they also have a bad taste in their mouth and might not necessarily want to become police officers or become administrators. For example, they might feel that the system is not one that serves them or serves their interests, and this isn't one worth participating in. It's a huge problem in terms of not having individuals who actually represent the community that they're serving. And that's an advocacy point for folks on the ground.
Do you see that changing anytime soon since this issue is now being exposed?
I hope so. Again, my concern is based off of the real numbers. So the criminal justice system is a huge beast of disparity and disproportionate consequences, primarily targeted at African Americans and Latino individuals. So a significant number of people are not even eligible to be able to participate in a lot of, whether it be the police force or city council or all these other things, because of felonies or contacts with police that increases their likelihood to not be able to participate fully in these systems, in these social circles. So Would I like it to change? Absolutely. I think that would be able to at least provide a little bit of an angle on changing some of the real situations that are happening every day. But in terms of it being a fast-moving process, I think that it might be slowed given the current state of where we are with police.
And you talked about trust, and this is an issue that we hear about on the show on a regular basis. Ella, you also talked about trust. In an interview with Al Jazeera English, interim police chief Al Eichhoff in Ferguson was asked how he would ensure African-Americans that they can trust the police. And he said, quote, "My officers now have body cameras. We have car cameras. They'll be held accountable for how they talk to people." What are your thoughts about these changes?
Well, it's not only the way you talk to people. It's how you treat people. You have to treat people with respect. If you want respect, you have to give respect. The police, they really need to take a big effort in how they interact with people. Yes, they may have a body cam or a camera in the car. It's hard, it's very hard for most African Americans to even want to approach them. So because of the way they have been treated in the past, I believe that the police need to reach out more. They need to get out of their cars, and they need to start walking in the neighborhoods and interact with the youth and the seniors. Until they get out their cars, I think we're going to start seeing more of what we have had in the past. You've got to get out the car. You've got to talk to people. You've got to treat people with respect. And I think that's the way we're going to improve.
We also talked about racial gaps, Ella. And on Tuesday, there's going to be a city election in Ferguson. You are running for city council. And according to reports, there are now more blacks who want to get involved in politics. Is that true? Is that what you're seeing?
It is. We have seen an increase of African Americans who want to be involved in politics since August.
And why are you why did you decide to run for city council?
I decided to run for city council over 2 years ago. I decided that when I went to the city council meeting one day, I saw five Caucasians and one African-American, and I said, that cannot happen anymore. Hmm. So I started getting involved. I continue to go to the city council meeting. I stressed the interest that I wanted to serve, and so I was appointed to the Human Rights Commission. In addition to that, I got involved into the local Democratic Club here. So because if I'm going to make an effort to be a leader, I must also learn the system that I want to lead in and make a difference. So we find that more African Americans are coming out and they want to be involved.
Well, thank you again for calling in, Mimi. Carl called in, and I think we're having some phone lines, so I'm sorry we dropped you, Carl. But Carl wants to know if it's possible to sue municipalities that engage in this type of money-making scheme. He says it sounds like a criminal investigation. And again, according to the Department of Justice report, fines from routine traffic stops, walking violations, failure to comply, and other petty offenses were used as money-making ventures by the city of Ferguson. The police chief boasted about this, saying that we beat our next biggest month in the last 4 years in revenue. The city manager responded, "Wonderful." They both resigned in March. The amount of revenue siphoned through citations rose 56% between 2011 and 2014, from $1.4 million to $2.3 million. The report says walking violations, $175. That's just one example. Chris, is it possible to sue over something like this?
I think it is, but unfortunately, I don't know the exact legal hook in order to be able to go. I think one of the challenges to being able to sue is being able to find out significantly, or being able to show that there was an actual intent to disenfranchise and discriminate against the individuals who are receiving all these fees. And so really getting in there, which I certainly hope there is a way, and I hope individuals will look at a way to sue effectively. But I think one of the challenges is generally with these kind of cases, figuring out how to prove there was an intent to do harm and to disenfranchise a particular group of folks. And that kind of leads into the finding with regard to Wilson. The little credible evidence to contradict Wilson was the finding from the DOJ report. And so I think for a lot of folks, there's a misunderstanding about what that means. I think there's not enough emphasis on understanding the kind of the legal standard, which is intent. So just because there is little credible evidence to contradict Wilson doesn't mean that he did not intend to do wrong by killing Mike Brown. It just means that there's not evidence to on the face, on the surface, to be able to say that he was trying to do it. And so that kind of goes into a lot of the work that we do with implicit bias. There are a lot of biases that all of us have, me included, that do not come to the surface and make it readily apparent that I'm executing or carrying out these biases when I interact or conduct myself in any kind of way. And for a lot of people, there are a lot of hidden biases against African Americans and Latino peoples throughout the country that are hard to prove legally when we're trying to figure out whether or not there was an intent to do particular individuals wrong versus whether or not they did it and they are able to kind of hide behind their feelings.
Well, thank you for the message, Carl. Sorry we hung up on you. We've got some phone line issues, so it'd be great if you can email your questions and comments to feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org, our website. Today, we are talking about the scathing DOJ report that looked at what's happening on the ground in Ferguson, where 21,000 people live. Blacks make up 63% of the population, but they account for 93% of arrests, 90% of citations. They're twice as likely to be searched as whites, but less likely to have drugs or weapons. Today, we're joined by Chris Bridges, a civil rights attorney with the Equal Justice Society. That's an organization that works to transform the nation's consciousness on race. Ella Jones has lived in Ferguson for 36 years. She sits on the city's Human Rights Commission, and she's running for Ferguson's city council. Chris, you brought up the other DOJ report. It was an 86-page report that cleared police officer Darren Wilson of civil rights violations in the shooting death of Michael Brown. The DOJ evaluated the testimony of more than 40 witnesses and said it found little credible evidence to contradict the account of Wilson. For example, they spoke with just a number of people, witnesses, who said that they actually weren't there. They got false information. According to the New York Times, one witness told investigators that she's a 31-year-old black woman. She was nervous about corroborating Darren Wilson's account, her initial account to investigators, in which she said that Wilson fired shots into Brown's back as he lay dead on the street, was inconsistent with the findings. When federal investigators challenged her, she admitted to lying, saying, quote, "You've got to live the life to know it." The DOJ said that they heard several witnesses who lied. What's your response to that report?
I think it's really unfortunate. I think it makes it very challenging and hard to, again, go at whether or not Darren Wilson actually killed Mike Brown with some form or amount of prejudice. So significant findings such as those are incredibly necessary in order to parse out the stories of eyewitnesses and folks who were actually there to be able to witness the interaction. And if they did not witness it accurately, or if they say one thing and something else happened, then that helps support the defense of Darren Wilson. Again, that does not dismiss what motivations might have actually been happening within Darren Wilson at the time of the murder of Mike Brown. It just means that in terms of facial surface evidence, you don't have much to stick on Wilson in pursuing charges against him.
The report says that 9 witnesses did not contradict or corroborate the officer, while 24 accounts were dissected and shown to lack credibility, according to federal investigators. Did this change the way that you understand what happened?
No. Well, not significantly. I think that, so a big piece of what I work on is implicit bias. And so there are significant studies. For example, one of the great leading social scientists in this area is Professor Jennifer Eberhardt. Individuals who continue to work on implicit bias. And implicit bias is basically biases that all individuals have when conducting their daily lives. And these biases are hidden. They're not necessarily known to individuals when they're walking down the street, when they see folks. It's similar to white folks who might be walking down the street and then clutch their purse. And they don't realize they're clutching their purse when they walk by a black person versus a white person. person. It's similar to police officers who are stopping African-Americans more, but don't realize that they're targeting African-Americans for stops or for arrests, which is very evident from the DOJ report, versus non-African-American or non-black individuals. Unfortunately, there are so many stories that were kind of dissected and broken down as not being credible. But that doesn't remove culpability on the part of Darren Wilson in terms of his actions in killing Mike Brown. And it doesn't fully articulate or answer whether or not Darren Wilson committed that murder with any kind of prejudice. And so that's a distinguishing factor for me, at least in terms of whether or not I'm surprised or whether or not it changes the narrative. Certainly, implicit bias is very new to many folks throughout the country. But for the folks working on the ground in this area every day, it's not new. And there are very real studies that support all the evidence of individuals actually carrying out actions with a very biased behavior. But having to prove that and show that and educate folks about their own internal biases is an ongoing process.
What about you, Ella? Again, you live in Ferguson. You've been there for 36 years. Federal agents rejected the hands up, don't shoot story, which, you know, has led to protests across the country. What are your thoughts on that? And did this investigation change the way you understand what happened in Mike Brown's killing?
It did not change the way that I believe he was killed. I really do believe his hands were up. I really do believe that. And it's just so sad that a lot of witnesses was discredited.
What are people talking about? What are you hearing from your colleagues and just people you interact with about that part of the report?
Well, a lot of people said the report is the report, and we have to abide by what the report came out with.
And that is Ella Jones. She's lived in Ferguson for 36 years, and she's running for Ferguson City Council. She sits on the city's Human Rights Commission. Chris Bridges is a civil rights advocate and attorney with the Equal Justice Society. And what was your reaction to also that part of the report? Did it change the way you understand what happened in the killing? A number of media outlets extensively quoted from people who testified during the process. And you can find links at yourcallradio.org. We'd love to hear from you. I think our lines are hopefully working again. So you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Rob in Monterey. Hi, Rob.
Yes, hi, good morning. I just read a very worthwhile and interesting book written by a young black female professor from one of the northern colleges about the black migration from the south to the northern cities. And she pointed out that the socioeconomic problems in those cities that had existed before the migration did persist, but the persons from the south were unfairly blamed for that, including by their black counterparts, when actual statistics showed that the black population actually was more productive for many years after they had arrived into those northern cities. My question is, the fact that the black populations, the black communities in many of the large northern cities do have, to a degree, certain socioeconomic problems that have persisted. That's one area that the book did not really address. And the fact that those problems have gone on, does that explain in part some of the reactions on the part of the police department, other than the sad fact that there are officers out there who do harbor bigotry?
You're talking about the economic situations?
The socioeconomic situation, the fact that there has been a certain amount of crime in the area, just a general struggle that those communities have experienced. Do you think that from a psychological standpoint that might have generated some of the enmity, unfair as it may be, on the part of law enforcement?
Well, we've done so many shows about this, and most of our guests say that most of it goes back to poverty. And Chris, some of the former black cops that we've had on the show say that part of the problem is that their white colleagues don't understand the culture. So just one example, but I think it's an important one. One of our former guests said that when he goes into, for example, West Oakland, you've got a group of young boys who are speaking loudly. That's just how they communicate, and maybe swearing. And he knows, and he you know, he kind of talks to them like that. Whereas the white cop will come in and bring in backup, and that's when the situation escalates. So you've got cultural differences, you've got economic issues. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think that's a really big statement and question to kind of dissect. I think there are certainly, just on a surface level, there's definitely cultural issues that are different between different ethnic groups and those representing different ethnic groups on a police force. So African-American police officers, for example, are probably more likely to understand and get the culture of African-American youth or African-American men, as opposed to white officers who come from a different place and or different experiences culturally or otherwise. And so the ways in which they interact with individuals on the street might differ completely, and that could significantly impact how much contact or the type of contact that's occurring with those youth and the bad taste in their mouth that might be left after that such an interaction. In terms of the socioeconomic piece, I think a significant portion of socioeconomic ability or movement upwards, at least, is very seriously based off of the amount of disproportionate contact with minority communities. So for a lot of individuals in the previous era pre-civil rights era, individuals had the Great Migration as a means of achieving freedom, as a means of escaping a lot of oppression in the South. In this day and age, in the 21st century, it's possible that freedom for African-Americans and other minority groups is primarily related to financial gain, financial access, financial freedom, because it doesn't matter where we are, we're still being disparately treated in a negative manner by all forms, whether it's the police department, the education system, the housing departments, et cetera, et cetera. And so the important piece of why Ferguson is significant to this overall process is based off of the disparate impact of police officers, the disparate arrests, the disparate citations, the disparate incarceration of African Americans and Latino people in the criminal justice system, which then significantly deters them from being able to fully participate and gain economic freedom in our society. So if a significant number of individuals, black, for example, in Ferguson, are being targeted by police officers, then they're not going to be able to have access to a better education, to jobs, to voting processes, for example, having felons or getting a felony after having such an interaction with police officers. And so this is a systemic problem that's very big and very complex and very much ingrained in the ways in which things are going on.
Well, thank you for calling, Ron. And to comment on the question you just made, we have another listener who emailed, "The report is revealing, but not in the way most media take it. It tells me even though Wilson was found not culpable of killing Brown, there is much culpability in the system. What the report shows is the system is rigged to be anti-black. The broken taillight is the least of it, a symptom of the problem, not the problem. The system first ill-educates minorities. We are ill-fed, receive little health care, including mental health. Of course, you're going to have more urban and inner city crime at higher rates due to these social conditions. You're going to have more police focus on these neighborhoods. Then you have Giuliani's legacy of the broken window policy going after petty crime as well, like Eric Garner. The result is more attacks against black youth and more casualties with these statistics, Darren Wilson or not. This is not a problem of good cop, bad cop."
I totally agree. It is a very systematic problem. It's a culture, and it's a sickness in terms of the ways in which we view incarceration and the ways in which we view penalties or criminal penalties. And all those things directly feed into the climate of these communities. When these communities are over-policed and have more interaction with officers, they're more likely to go to jail. They're more likely to be incarcerated, which significantly impacts their ability to have jobs, their ability to provide for their families, their ability to keep their families together. A significant portion of individuals who are arrested are for nonviolent, non-serious matters, right? So a lot of these folks are just being targeted in ways that are not only disparate, but incredibly damaging to their ability to thrive and survive within their own communities, let alone the broader country.
And just quickly, Ella, what are your thoughts on economics here and poverty? This issue got quite a bit of attention last year. A report from the Brookings Institute came out and found that Ferguson's unemployment rate rose from 7% in 2000 to 13% in 2012. And during that same period, the poor population doubled. Between 2000 and 2012, the poor population doubled. So what role does that play here?
It plays a lot here because it's kind of concentrated in one area of the city, And I just believe that they over-police that area. The African-American population is basically concentrated in that part of the city. I think we should do a better job of helping people find jobs. We need jobs here. And not only jobs, but we need to educate the people. We need to have where some of these young men who are over the age of 18, they can get some on-the-job training. I think if we could give them jobs, and not only jobs, but help them emotionally and physically, I think that would work. People want to do better. However, there are no doors that are being opened for people to walk in to do better. We got to open more doors for people. People want to work. People want to have a good family. People want to be good citizens. They are tired of being oppressed, and it becomes the responsibility of the private sector and the government and the city, whomever. Let's start creating some jobs. Let's start building some houses. Let's start renovating some houses. Let's start getting better health care, mental health care for people. So people do want to do better, and we've got to find a way to help people to do better.
Ella Jones has lived in Ferguson for 36 years. She's president of the Ferguson Township Open Democratic Club, and she's running for Ferguson City Council next Tuesday. Chris Bridges is a civil rights advocate and attorney with the Equal Justice Society. They work to transform the nation's consciousness on race. Today we've been talking about the DOJ report that found evidence of systemic racial bias throughout the Ferguson Police Department and local system. And you can find more information about this report at yourcallradio.org. Ella and Chris, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. How do nonprofit health insurance companies like Blue Shield operate? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Michael Johnson, a former Blue Shield policy director, who says the company is no different than its for-profit competitors. He recently resigned over high premiums, multi-million dollar salaries, and billions in profits. California recently agreed to revoke Blue Shield's tax-exempt status. Johnson says the company should give back the profits it made. Do you agree? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Nock Nguyen produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.